What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump, and it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show, and the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners, and if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. And today, we've got everybody but Jake Dello. We've got Gabby Magnuson.
Hey.
Pete McKenzie.
Hello.
And Kiara Mitchell.
Hello.
Hello.
The best part about that was that this is the only time, I think, that Van has got Jake's last name right, and Jake's over.
When he's not here.
That's true.
So... two quick hits. One is that if you've been following the news, you know that Portland, Oregon, it looks in media like a war zone. What's really weird is that in the fever dreams, far right wing imagination and the white supremacy imagination, Portland is this weird city of anarchism. It's actually like this very placid, progressive place, and it's pretty cosmopolitan. Lots of people like eating hemp seeds and avocado toast and that kind of thing. Everybody reads and wears flannel. But in going back to like the 80s, Republicans have always kind of dog whistled at it as a place of the chaos that's just around the corner. And Trump has turned that dog whistle into like a giant blaring siren, basically. It has been a site of a lot of Black Lives Matter protests, but like pretty peaceful. And except for some agent provocateurs who are largely right-wingers anyway, it's been nonviolent, but Trump, because it's an election year and he's trying to portray himself as law and order slash fascism, he is using Department of Homeland Security authorities which was set up after 9/11, to deploy federal forces to Portland. But the federal forces are little green men. They're not wearing like FBI uniforms. It's not some national police. It's secret police. And what they're doing, and the Washington Post, Bellingcat, and a bunch of other places have reported on this, they've been going around, driving around unmarked vans, not wearing identifying uniforms as law enforcement officers, and snatching protesters off the streets to detain them. This is literally Gestapo stuff. It's literally secret police stuff. There's no authority to do this without identifying yourself. The legal, even if they did identify themselves as law enforcement, the legality of this in a municipality, in a city, is questionable or contestable anyway. But so the mayor of Portland is kind of under siege here, because, and Trump is threatening to send more federal forces. Right. So there's you have protests and you have the police clashing with protesters, but you also have the secret police driving around snatching people. It's super fucking scary. And I wanted to flag it, one, because this is like like I said, the right wing imaginary. It's Portland that's ground zero for civil war. Like one of the first episodes of this podcast, I did a special like mini episode about that. And that's the risk that we're facing right now for real. And so somebody asked me, if you're advising the mayor, this was on Facebook, like if you're advising the mayor of Portland, what would you tell him to do? And so I tried to take, reposted it on Twitter, but like, I tried to just think through, okay, as a strategist, like how would you deal with this if you're the mayor of Portland? And it seems to me that your goal is to stop the secret police from snatching people on the streets, prevent the federal government from deploying troops or forces into your city. I mean, those would be like the main goals. In the process of talking about this with some people who are both political scientists and Portland residents, or they're from Portland, it came out that like Portland PD, the police department, has been completely corrupted or infiltrated by the alt-right. So there's a bunch of police officers who should be an asset for the mayor to assert control of the city, but who are aligned with Trump. And some of them are aligned with actual white supremacists. There are neo-Nazis in the Portland Police Department. That is a major, like if you're the mayor, that's a major threat. And that really debases what would be a major asset for you to realize your goals. So this is like all very fucking scary and complicated. And what do you do? What would you guys do?
So out of curiosity, having read up on all this like Portland stuff, is that the biggest reason why it seems like the mayor has so little power in his neck of the woods kind of deal? Are there like other factors that like play into it, or?
Well, this is the dilemma. Like, what do you actually do? He needs the police to quell protests, or to like keep protests nonviolent, right? To minimize, it's his job to minimize destruction of the city. But the one thing that I recommended initially was that he use the police to arrest anybody who's caught trying to detain protesters that's not wearing a law enforcement uniform. So like basically you arrest the secret police, and like that sounds very combustible and risky, but your hand has been forced here. We are living in a different universe now. So yeah, like it's not your fault that conflict could result or that civil war could result. You have to maintain your own responsibilities here. And so the logical thing is to try and use the police to keep out or push down the secret police. But that was when it came out that, oh, actually, they're a bunch of like alt-righters. That's a huge fucking problem. So that means one of your other goals, like a very near-term goal, has to be to find police who are on your side, who are willing to take a knee, who are, you know, basically believe in the Constitution, who are going to not support the Trump position, not support white supremacy or whatever, neo-Nazis. And so like there are ways to work through this, but this is like a very serious problem, and it's like happening so fast that and it's so politicized that like it seems like it's going to get worse before it gets better. But definitely worth keeping an eye on.
I think a lot of politics would be better if people were more familiar with the Streisand effect, which is like where you attempt to hide or remove or censor someone, it just exacerbates the information or exacerbates that person's reaction.
Yeah.
And you could argue that that's what's happening here, but I don't think it is. Like, I think the aim that Trump has here is not to suppress protests, but is exactly to exacerbate the protests. The protests that are happening, he thinks feeds into his narrative of a law and order fight on forces of anarchy, and are going to help in his electoral struggle, which is terrifying.
Yeah, he clearly, and that was the whole like tear gas in Lafayette Square thing in Washington, D.C. He's trying to create the imagery of conflict and chaos. Like that's actually what he wants. I think the material reality on the ground in Portland is immaterial to him. That's not what matters. And that's why we see all of these organic reports coming out of Portland showing how normal life is, and then saying, if life is this normal, why are there secret police fucking snatching bodies? And why is Trump threatening to send more forces? You know, and I think the answer is that because it doesn't matter what's actually happening in Portland, what matters is that he needs to sow chaos. He is the agent of chaos, you know, and it's a little bit askew of like our normal foreign policy conversations, except that like thinking through this stuff strategically as if it was in another country is kind of what we're uniquely positioned to do, because we try to think strategically and we are living physically in another country. So I don't know that anybody else in an American podcast could have this perspective on it.
It's hard at the moment to keep up with the chaos of the world and in politics. No. There's so much going on. You see it one day, but forget it the next day because another thing pops up.
Yeah. If you ever listen to an old episode of this podcast, even just like from a few weeks ago or something, it's like a time capsule. It's so weird. You're like, oh, that happened? Oh, that felt like it was 5 years ago. It's fucking crazy. Anyways, the other news is that Trump toady Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, he just literally just gave a speech at the Nixon Library that was very political. And the S, like, I mean, throwing shade at Biden, overtly political, overtly for Trump. It was kind of like him trying out for his own run at the presidency. And the whole speech was about how we lost the China wager, but like even more so. He declared in very explicit terms that engagement with China has been a massive failure. We expected China to change. It did not. We have empowered a monster. He laid down the groundwork for businesses that or companies that do business in China. They're going to face greater and greater costs, greater and greater scrutiny. The political risk of operating or relying on China for a corporation is going to become too prohibitive to last into the future. He's not saying everybody needs to decouple from China. He's describing a bunch of decisions that the United States is going to make that's going to force everybody to divest from China. Or you're going to have to align with a country that is committing a genocide in real time in Xinjiang. That's a hard, awful thing. I will say you heard it here first. I mean, like we talked about this happening way before people thought it was even conceivable. And now he's giving a speech where it's like, literally, like it could not be more explicit. The truth is that our policies and those of other free nations resurrected China's failing economy only to see Beijing bite the international hands that fed it. You fucking dick. That's what he said, minus the fucking dick part. So like this is again like brave new world stuff. He invokes the language of the Cold War over and over. The free world must triumph over this new tyranny. Yeah, I don't know. This is the biggest pivotal thing that's happening outside of the U.S. right now. And it's the U.S. that's like sort of forcing it along, I think. Oh, yeah. And then he took occasion to throw shade at Biden in the speech, too, which is like he's on the Secretary of State's plane and travel money. So that's illegal. But so is like everything else that happens in this administration. So who knows?
Did he particularly choose this place like on purpose?
Oh, yeah.
Like the Nixon Library?
Fuck. That's a good point. Yes, he did. So the speech started out with praising Nixon's no good and noble intentions in opening China to the world, but it has come to naught and must be abandoned. And so like it was closing a circle. It's saying, look, Nixon opened a brave new world for us all, and we have to close it. Our exposure to, you know, death and destruction and tyranny is so great. Obviously, he's like overselling it a bit, but it's so great that we have to repudiate the Nixon legacy. We need to periodize it and understand that it was like a finite point in time and that time is done. So like this is laying down all kinds of markers, trying to lock in for the future this turn away from China that has started under Trump.
Oh my God, is he an idiot? Isn't he sounds like he's like trying to start like an actual war, right?
We'll see. Decoupling, one of the things about decoupling that's true is it creates space for more conflict. You don't have to worry about the negative consequences on your business interests if you end up fighting because you don't have business interests in that relationship anymore. Decoupling creates space for conflict. And like, that's one of my major concerns. That's actually my main reservation because like otherwise there's the genocide. I said this on Twitter, like the genocide is a really strong case for decoupling. It's really hard to justify maintaining business interests in a country that is so egregiously against human rights. Like genocide is just a different category of oppression. But, you know, if it makes conflict more likely, that's also not great, or that's also like a major problem that needs to be addressed. So like decoupling doesn't seem to be like an obvious answer, but it should be part of the conversation. I just wish it wasn't being a conversation led by these fucking clowns.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
Okay, cool. So this week is Prediction Market. I'm stealing the spot. I'm taking the spotlight from Jake. Many apologies. And our first question is, whether coming on the heels of the UK suspending its extradition treaty with Hong Kong over China's new national security law, will any other great powers end their respective extradition treaties with Hong Kong before September?
So I think the answer is yes. This is one of the agenda items that the U.S. is going around badgering friendly countries or countries who will give them an audience. They have a laundry list of things that they want other countries to do on China. And all of it sort of pushes in the punishment, cost imposition, sanction, isolation. Like, it's all in that basket of statecraft. And this is one of the issues that's in it. I don't know how high of a priority it is, especially because, like, even the United States has pretty large business interests that run through Hong Kong. So I don't know how much of a sense of urgency there is, but I would be willing to wager that before September, some other countries or some other great powers will also suspend their extradition treaty with Hong Kong.
It's also super interesting hearing that the US is taking this agenda around its kind of partner countries, particularly in light of recent events here in New Zealand, where two lawmakers in New Zealand's parliament, both of whom had ties to one degree or another with CCP United Front organizations, have both announced that they're resigning. And it seems quite clear, this is speculation, but it seems quite clear that it's a coordinated decision by political leaders in New Zealand on the advice of security agencies or diplomats. So it seems like that agenda is having success, at least in patches.
It looks,
I mean, I'd be interested
to
hear what you think.
No, that's true. Like, I think people would like to see politicians who are suspected of being compromised by Chinese intelligence services or by the CCP itself. Like, I think especially Washington would like to see some sort of like punishment or investigation doled out to these people. But just even the fact of like being forced to resign, even without, you know, specifying reasons why or without acknowledging reasons why, that's still something. And it kind of like it's not necessarily a result of U.S. pressure is the thing. Like, this is what you should be doing in your own national interest if you care about foreign interference in your own political processes. This is just prudent to do of your own accord. Or like, you can see how China is behaving on the international stage and with other countries and be like, yeah, I'm not so into this imperialism, man. And so like... That happens to also be what the U.S. wants, but in some ways, it's like the U.S. heavy-handedness makes it harder for countries to do what would be the right thing anyway. But yeah, like, it is notable that, like, I guess a good way to phrase it is like, this is more China own goaling, or like, this is like, China is still its own worst enemy, even as the United States tries to take that position.
Okay, cool. And we'll put a pin in that there, because we're going to discuss China's own goals in our country analysis.
Oh, yeah.
So for question two, coming on the heels of Egypt's parliament approving sending troops to Libya, will any other Arab states formally assist in the Libyan civil war before September?
Man, I don't know. I'll be totally honest. I'm like not tracking this at all. I'm going to say no, but don't ask me for a reason why. I have no fucking, like, I'm just not tracking this.
And our third question comes after Russia is alleged to have fired a satellite weapon into space. And previously there's been satellites that might have military capabilities or even might have offensive capabilities, but none that seem so explicitly like weaponry as in this case. Will Western powers, like the US and the UK, also deploy satellites with weapon capabilities into space before the end of the year?
Oh, interesting. So I'm going to say no. Not that the United States doesn't, not that it's not militarizing space or that it doesn't have a space force, clearly. But I don't know about any space launches that are scheduled, and like, that just might be my own ignorance. And I don't foresee one getting scheduled simply in relation to Russia launching a satellite weapon. Although satellite weapons are like, or anti-satellite weapons are very concerning to the defense community. There's been a lot less attention on Russia with this than with China, but this is one of the reasons why the Pentagon thinks that it has to invest so much in advanced military hardware, because space is like the strategic high ground now, and you have to own it. And to the extent that China has been able to put stuff up into space, and now Russia, or weapons, not stuff, then that creates arms racing dynamic in space.
Literally all I can think of after hearing that space is now the high ground is Obi-Wan as Russia and China and America Anakin screaming
that was my
at each other.
Same thought.
I have the high ground. Anyway, moving on. That's the end of our prediction podcast.
All right.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
All right, for Stay Off Twitter, I got two. One is from Patrick Iber, who is a scholar, historian of the Cold War. He's a leftist, a good progressive. And he just says, everyone hates comments section, especially unmoderated comment sections. And yet we spend time on this website, Twitter, which is an unmoderated comment section without the rest, as in like the good stuff from articles. And that is why we have Stay Off Twitter, man. This is like, that's pretty close to my view of Twitter. And it's not that it's like has no redeeming value, but, you know, it's the place where you go to see your uncle shouting in all caps, you know, or like some person who is completely without credentials telling you your business and trying to put you in your place on a public stage when you've invested 20 years of your life in an issue versus their 0 years. You know, like it's this great democratizer, but kind of in the worst way imaginable, or like the downside of democratization. And so like the comparison to unfiltered, unmoderated comment section of a website that tracks with my understanding. And so I wanted to give it a shout out.
There's a great meme hanging around the internet from The Simpsons, which is just two chimps screaming at each other with knives in hand, with like all of the circus characters positioned around them. That is just like, that meme is my understanding of Twitter.
Yeah.
And I love it. Twitter. Like, I love watching that kind of horrific knife fight. It's great.
You know what? I understand what you're saying, and I think you're not wrong. And it disturbs me deeply that your understanding of something and my understanding of something apparently is a meme.
Communication.
This full circle.
Holy
like,
shit, yeah.
I'm
holy fuck.
So disturbed. Deeply terrifying. Somewhat less disturbing is the second tweet. See that pivot?
Subtle.
Matt Duss, friend of the pod.
Matt's a pro.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders foreign policy advisor. So he had this long tweet thread that we'll link to about progressive foreign policy. So the Democratic Party's platform, which is like its stated position going into the election on like all manner of issues. There's a foreign policy section to the Democratic Party platform. And in it, it lays out all kinds of stuff that it redounds to the progressive worldview. Presumably, like, you know, Matt was consulted on this in some way. And it invokes a lot of language that suggests that the mealy, warm center of the Democratic Party, the like, you know, dominated by conventional wisdom part of the Democratic Party, is accepting some new wisdoms, right? Not unlike the piece that we talked about in Armchair Analysis last episode, where, you know, you can get the small wins. This party platform has some small wins in it. It doesn't talk about a new worldview. There's no unified theory of how we do politics or foreign policy, but it rejects it. First of all, it embraces the emergency that is climate change. It rejects the authority to use military force that has underpinned all of the American counterterrorism operations since 9/11. It invokes the language of like endless wars, forever wars, as something that obviously needs to stop. Right-sizing our presence in the Middle East. Not doing business with dictatorships. It explicitly, it's not perfect. Like there are some very like conventional wisdom-y kind of things about the platform. And like, ironically, Asia is the place where all the language is the most status quo-y. But it had one point on China that is like super interesting, because it explicitly says Democrats see China as a challenge or a threat, but it's not primarily a military one. That is my, that's like somebody listening to the fucking podcast, you know? Yeah, China's a fucking problem. We have a lot of issues and see a lot of concerns. They're a threat to what we value as a fucking, you know, democratic society. And yet that's not primarily a military problem. And so there was a huge decentering of the military threat that China poses and a huge centering of the sort of political threat that China poses, which is very, like, it's hard to get a consensus on China stuff, but like that's at least like where I stand on this. And so like that was a pleasant surprise. And Matt just says, look, these shifts in the party platform, like they didn't happen by accident, right? It's because people like Bernie Sanders, like Matt, were pushing for a different worldview. And some of these issue changes were part of that worldview. And he links to the work of a bunch of different progressive advocacy groups and progressive NGOs who have been trying to change the conversation. This whole progressive movement on foreign policy that we end up talking about like every episode. Like, I hate the term Overton window, but like it has created new conventional wisdoms about ending forever wars, right? About not pursuing regime change, about the centrality of like environmental degradation to the politics of foreign policy, like all this stuff, you know? And so we're doing something, you know, collectively. And he even cites a couple think tanks, like the Quincy Institute, which we've talked about before. It's progressive, but progressive in like a very peculiar kind of way, where they're just wanting to like largely retrench from the world militarily. And then like the Quincy Institute released a report on how to change Middle East policy that mostly involves peeling back the military, right? But then CNAS, which is like an establishment think tank that I'm affiliated with, full disclosure, they have a report that he also linked to on Middle East policy, making most of the same recommendations as the Quincy Institute. That shows that the center has shifted, man. So not so much on Asia, but on the Middle East and on a lot of other issues. So like changes are happening.
Right. So my first tweet of the week comes from Ken Schultz, who is a professor of political science at Stanford University. And his tweet follows Defense Secretary Mark Esper's statement that says that the Pentagon is considering adjustments, I say in quotes, to its military presence in South Korea and around the globe as it shifts from years of countering insurgencies and militants in the greater Middle East to focus on China. Schultz's response, low-key, is as funny as it gets. He tweeted out, "Too bad for South Korea that they're located in the Middle East and not near China." Eye rolling emoji. Yeah. So like,
I like how you quoted the emoji.
Yeah, I did. It was really important, you know. But like, aside from the drag, it seemed kind of concerning that this was like an official response. So like, does Esper actually have any idea of South Korea's proximity to China, or is there like something else behind the statement, Van?
No, it's ridiculous. To some extent, it's like, what can you even say when the stupidity dribbles out like this? So just to be like extremely clear here, because like the statement that Esper made was like so ridiculous that I seriously had to read it like four times. Like I didn't understand and I still don't, except by Ken Schultz's snark. That's the only way that I can like comprehend this, because he's saying we might need to withdraw troops from South Korea to deal with China as we shift away from the Middle East. Okay, so we need... I can't even fucking finish. So we need to shift from the Middle East toward China. And to do that, we're going to pull troops out of the place that's closest to China. Are you
Someone
fucking...
Someone failed geography class.
Fuck, man. It's so stupid. It's like they're not even trying, you know? Esper is trying to rationalize Trump's hatred of South Korea and hatred of alliances in general. And like the writing is on the wall that the U.S. is going to withdraw troops from South Korea. Is it going to be total? I don't know. Is it going to be done by like in the cover of darkness by total surprise? I don't know. Is it going to be just a stunt? Probably. But like something having to do with troop withdrawal is going to fucking happen. You heard it here fucking first. And Mark Esper is loading up the reason for it to cover Trump's tracks like a good Quisling would. And except the problem is that it makes no fucking sense, man. And the fact that it makes no fucking sense is proof that he's being a Quisling covering for fucking Trump. So thank you, Ken Schultz.
So on to my second tweet of the week, I've got from James Palmer, who's a deputy editor over at Foreign Policies magazine. This tweet follows the news that Chinese diplomats were burning documents after the State Department ordered the closure of Beijing's consulate in Houston. To this series of events, Palmer tweets, "I can't get over how stupid the 'if they were burning papers, they must have something to hide' line was about Houston. Of course they had something to hide. It was a consulate. The US does the exact same thing, destroying confidential information when forced out." He continues going, "It's a government building in a foreign country. Just about everything in there is confidential. It doesn't imply any kind of malfeasance. China does lots of shady shit in the United States. We have pretty good evidence of it doing that shady shit already. We don't have to make up dumb circumstantial stuff," which I think was pretty on point.
Yes. I think this is, so what's crazy about this is that his, James Palmer's response to all this, which to me is quite reasonable, is itself getting politicized. Like, people are responding to his response with people being like Trump MAGA fucking psychos, that the Trump MAGA people are saying that anybody who says that, oh, there's nothing to see here, like, we do it, they do it, everybody does it, it's secret stuff in consulates, anyone who says that doesn't know how extensive the CCP's reach is and how bad the stuff they're doing is. But it's like, we know that. And like, that's part of James Palmer's thread, is like, we know China is a fucking malicious actor and it does all kinds of like secretive, subversive shit. We're sort of trying to deal with that. That doesn't mean that you should use the excuse that they were burning documents as a reason for forcing closure of the consulate. So this is all just weird. And the disturbing thing to me was that this went public, this notification of like closing the consulate, because the Chinese like outed it first. Like, the State Department or whatever didn't tell us this was happening first. And then they just acknowledged it, explained it. It's all very, again, if you're going to have like economic decoupling, there's going to be a degree of political decoupling to go with that too. Like, consulates exist partly to serve economic ties, economic interests. So like, the closure of this consulate is one more step toward decoupling, even as people are like, well, that's unconscionable, or like, decoupling could never fully happen or whatever. And yet it's still sort of plodding along anyway.
Incidentally, James Palmer is without doubt my favorite Twitter personality. He is utterly hilarious. If you're going to follow anyone, you should definitely follow James.
Yeah, he's got some of the, along with Matt Duss, he's got some of the best hot takes.
Oh, 100%.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
Sweet. So for Armchair Analysis this week, we have a piece from Inkstick Media titled "The Myth of Chinese Strategic Genius," and it's by a guy called Peter Charles. And it's an interesting piece. We hinted at it before in the pod. This idea that Chinese behavior is very distinct and separate from the myth of Chinese strategic genius that has evolved over the past few decades. And this myth of Chinese strategic genius is really entrenched in a lot of commentary and foreign policy analysis. But it is a myth, because while China's run between 1978 and 2008 was incredible, in the piece, Peter Charles says they went from impoverished backwater to industrial powerhouse. And it is kind of staggering to think about how marked a shift they underwent. It was largely a result of strong tailwinds, is his argument, that they had this massive rural population, which, while poor, was relatively educated and capable of being reassigned to cheap industrial labor to radically increase economic input, that American engagement and a commitment to support, that there was American engagement and a commitment to supporting China in order to offset the Soviet Union, that there was this neoliberal consensus which masked the negative consequences of moving productive capacity from the West to China, so China could take advantage of it to a really significant degree without incurring backlash. And there was this near limitless domestic demand in China, which won them ardent supporters among exporter countries overseas. And crucially, that those conditions have now disappeared, that China has largely run through its surplus rural population, the working age population is now shrinking, that worker demands are rising, that not only is the old Cold War over, but we're now seemingly coming into a new one with China as the principal antagonist. And that other regional powers like Japan, like South Korea, like ASEAN to some extent, are increasingly suspicious and scared of Chinese behavior. Mm-hmm. And the change in those circumstances means that whereas previously Chinese successes were magnified and their failures were minimized, now that's flipped. And that's particularly problematic for China because there are a lot of failures. And Charles gives a whole bunch of examples, but I think the most effective one that he uses was the border clash between India and China, which seems to have been unprovoked and was initiated by China. So they had this, not only did they have a number of casualties, there wasn't any justification for it, but it also empowered Indian hardliners. It's encouraged discussion of greater Indian alignment with US security interests. It's been this massive own goal, and that's a real, in Peter Charles' narrative, a real theme in Chinese foreign policy, which China has now called wolf warrior diplomacy. And he's got this great line about how if you have to name your foreign policy after a jingoistic blockbuster, then you're not exactly signaling security, your stability and your behavior.
Yeah.
I thought that on the whole, it was a really good piece and a really interesting piece pushing back at this kind of widely accepted understanding of China as like playing three-dimensional chess. Well, I mean, what did you think of it, Ben?
Yeah, like I loved this piece as a revisionist take on sort of conventional wisdom about China, like you say. It can go too far because China is, I mean, they come up with 5-year plans for their fucking economy. Right? The PLA is operating on 30-year investment timelines. Like, they clearly pursue strategies, but when you look at their foreign policy, the ubiquitousness of own goals suggests that they fucking suck in many respects. They are incompetent. It's just different from the kind of incompetence of the Trump administration. Like, and it should fucking scare the shit out of everybody that the two great powers are both strikingly incompetent in world affairs. China really is its own worst enemy. And like the piece goes down the list of countries that China has actively alienated who used to be sympathetic to them not that long ago. You know, like New Zealand is going to be on this list. I feel like we're in a transition process. But like I remember Sweden 5-6 years ago, you had Swedish scholars of international relations and like foreign policy elites in Sweden seriously defending China and sort of maligning the United States as the problem, even in like the Obama rebalance era, right? But in a matter of just a few years, China's own foreign policy towards Sweden has like alienated the entire government and made them realize that like there is a genuine threat here. It's just, let's put the asterisk on it. It's not the kind of threat that requires like aircraft carriers necessarily. You know what I mean? This piece was, I don't know, I felt like it had good structure and prose to it, like things like hyper-jingoistic action blockbuster, like phrases like that really like capture the imagination. But the broader point of it, I felt like was a very good reminder, right? China is not 10 feet tall. It's very ham-handed. The so what, or like my concern is that to the extent this is correct, we should worry about China tripping over its own dick into a war. We can't count on China to be the hyper-rationalists. We can't count on them to make the good calculation every time. Things can escalate. They can maneuver themselves into bad wars, you know, just like the US did back in the day. I mean, not even that long ago. What am I saying?
Back in the day, as in literally yesterday.
Yeah. Back in the every single fucking decision we make. All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
Okay, the first question this week is from Georgi Kuroski. Sorry for the mispronunciation of your name. Big fan here. I was wondering whether you are familiar with the work of Adam Curtis, and if you are, what do you think of it? Do you agree with the narrative that he put trays of the past 50 years in the West and in the Middle East?
So if it's the Adam Curtis that I'm thinking of, I actually saw a BBC documentary about the documentaries that he makes. But I've never seen any of his documentaries directly because he's like an interesting character or like an interesting person. But I have not seen his work. And I don't know what he says about the Middle East. His take on the West, I also don't know what that means. I guess I'm not being very helpful here. But my understanding of like his political view or his worldview is that like he thinks that we suffer developmentally as human beings because we are all atomized and like individuals in capitalism. But he's also like a libertarian. He's not like a Marxist or something. And so I don't even know how to describe his worldview. And so I guess I don't have a lot to say here. He is foreign to me because he's British and I am not British.
The second question this week is from Adam G. And we kind of covered this a bit with Matt Duss or in his tweet. It says, did you see the Democratic Party platform on foreign policy? Matt Duss says it's progressive. Do you agree?
Ah, yeah. So we did sort of cover this. It's not as... So there are definitely progressive things in this. Maybe I'm more progressive than Matt. I don't know. That seems like a thing I could not possibly say. But there are like the things that are... There are things that in my wheelhouse that are very not progressive about this. It offers no solution and no realism on North Korean nukes. Doesn't mention anything about like... ending the Korean War. It doesn't do anything on like kleptocracy, right? Transnational corruption is like not much of a feature here, which again is like a blind spot in the sort of status quo. And it doesn't touch at all the sort of sacred cows of the Pentagon. So like American military force structure, the size and shape of the military, doesn't say anything about it. The American way of war, the concepts that we use to go to war with that justify the size and shape of the military, doesn't say anything about that. It's all in the, like, the progressive stuff is all in the areas of U.S. foreign policy that don't tread on the interest group, like the things that interest groups value and lobbyists value for the most part. The most radical stuff is on Middle East, which is definitely progressive. I don't want to demean the document because like it's, if you compare it to the 2016 Democratic Party platform with Hillary, it is a giant leap forward. I'm not going to say great leap forward, but it's progressive by that measure. It's just very much like a work in progress. So like I would say it has progressive elements to it. There are progressive wins in there. But I can understand why people might be unhappy with it or with parts of it.
What we got this week?
A refusal to say great leap forward is Van's new way of saying I'm not a communist.
Not a Marxist. It's a kind of cultural revolution. Just kidding.
Got him on record, boys.
Jake, you might need to edit that one out.
He's just gonna add it to his blackmail folder.
Giving him ammunition. All right, gang, that's gonna do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic for the World Politics Review newsletter, our sponsor, and buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to, you know, just wantonly send us money. And that'll do it. Until next time, peace.